Today's lesson in geopolitical economics goes like this. Just because sanctions work with one country doesn't mean they work with another, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 6th of January today. Turns out it may be, we're not really sure yet, but we don't think so, probably wasn't a hydrogen bomb that the North Koreans tested yesterday. Scientists are still looking at all their data. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said today that the blast wasn't consistent with an H-bomb. But all of that said, geopolitical nerves have indeed been jangled. The UN Security Council put together a hasty meeting today at which it strongly condemned the North Korean test and, oh, by the way, promised more sanctions on that country as well. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with how sanctions have been working so far.
President Obama has called North Korea the most isolated, most sanctioned, most cut off nation on earth. Bruce Klingner at the Heritage Foundation says there's a lot more we could be doing.
The U.S., EU, and UN imposed far stronger sanctions and targeted financial measures on Iran. Unilaterally, the U.S. has targeted more entities from Iran, Balkans, Cuba, Zimbabwe than we have North Korea.
But if North Korea's economy is in dire straits, and woe is it, says Klingner, that's less due to sanctions, more its government. Sung-Yung Lee is at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
North Korea is the only country in world history to have suffered a famine despite being a literate, urbanized, industrialized society.
Even so, Lee says the North Korean regime lives extravagantly, funded by dubious means.
Like the sale of drugs, illicit substances, counterfeit U.S. $100 bills, weapons, and so forth.
And then there's China. Even though Beijing has condemned North Korea's nuclear testing, Stefan Haggard at UC San Diego says it's China that's keeping North Korea's economy afloat.
Virtually all of North Korea's trade and investment is with China. Our estimates are that it could be as much as 80%.
He says as long as that relationship continues, the regime will likely plod along and stay in power. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Back home, this was another rough day in equities. All three major stock indices finished in the red, and not by a little bit either, but we'll get to that. Twitter has been having a rougher go than most, mostly because it's not growing fast enough to please its big investors. So it's thinking about chucking its signature element, the 140-character limit on tweets. This week, CEO Jack Dorsey has been hinting quite strongly that tweets could soon get a lot bigger, like 10,000 characters bigger. Theory being that opening the gates to longer tweets might make the services more appealing and thus profitable. All of which is to say Twitter is in a tricky situation familiar to a whole lot of tech companies. How to attract new users without alienating the old ones. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more on that from New York.
Technology execs love the word pivot. It's a noun, it's a verb, it's what they call making a big change in how they do business. Striking down its famous character limit could certainly earn Twitter pivot points, but there is potential danger, explains Karen North, professor of social media at USC.
Probably their biggest risk is that they are changing the thing that most identifies them. And all of a sudden you think, well, why am I doing this? It doesn't do anything special, or whatever was special about it is no longer there.
Twitter has 320 million users a month with little growth. Presumably, they're fairly happy with Twitter as is. And some are already tweeting about how much they hate the idea of a 10,000-character tweet. But with Instagram racing past it and Facebook way ahead, Twitter kind of has to try something new to become more mainstream. Constance Helfat teaches technology strategy at Dartmouth Business School.
I mean, I remember when Amazon first went beyond books, there was a big hoo-ha among their users. Oh, my gosh, you know, so it's going to be terrible. Well, it worked out fine.
Netflix changed from DVD by mail to streaming and came out ahead after some early bumps. And this kind of change is not just a tech thing. It even happens in the dusty old world of cable TV. Bravo used to be a channel that showed ballet. Now it's a snake pit of conniving housewives and cutthroat chefs. Nobody at Bravo worries about the classy viewers it lost when it shed its skin. Twitter may well do something dramatic to go after a whole new audience. If current users don't like it, they've got a platform where they can take their moaning worldwide. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
As I said, Wall Street today, forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've got a spare $600 and a couple of months to wait, the future is now, well, in sight anyway. Virtual reality is the new thing at the Consumer Electronics Show going this week in Las Vegas. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is there and on it. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm well. Listen, not to malign CES at all, but is there actual stuff happening with VR, virtual reality, or is it another year of, oh, it's coming soon?
Well, okay, it's half and half, because yes, the last few years have been VR is coming, VR is coming, VR is coming. But now VR has pre-orders. So
oh,
it's still technically coming soon, but it has a shipping date, and that's for the big dog, Oculus Rift.
All right, well, so what's it going to be like when this thing comes out? I mean, it's a PC and a what else?
Yeah, so it's goggles. It's big, heavy goggles, and they have these really interesting controllers. Those are actually delayed because the technology around that's so hard. So when you first get your Rift, you will get goggles and an Xbox One controller, and you'll plug it into a PC. Now, you need a PC that's so powerful that they're actually going to start selling bundles that include the Oculus Rift headset and a computer. Those are going to be about $1,500. So they expect that those are not going to be the most popular sort of market for virtual reality. It's high-end gaming, and there are actually two completely different ways to do VR. One is this kind of PC virtual reality where it is tethered to that computer. And then there's the one that sprung up while we were all waiting for Oculus, and that's mobile virtual reality. And that's where you just pop a phone into some kind of a headset.
Right.
But Oculus is actually in both. So they make the hardware behind the Samsung Gear VR. That's a mobile device. I think that's the way that a lot of people will experience virtual reality. And actually, it just so happens, the CEO of Oculus, Brendan Erieb, agrees with me.
PC VR is most likely going to be a smaller category of enthusiasts and gamers than broad mobile VR. Mobile VR at $99 is a much more affordable price point for a much broader audience.
All right, but Molly, $99 or, you know, $1,500, what am I going to do with this thing? And let me bring out my inner Luddite here and admit that, you know, it looks great, but gaming can't be all that.
Well, I will say there's a report out actually just this week that says that virtual reality video gaming will probably be up to a $5.1 billion market just in 2016.
Huh.
So that might be worth it for some of these companies.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we're actually seeing a lot more of that. And here's a read on what else is happening in VR.
You're seeing things in architecture and simulation, in medical, automotive, just across the board. There's a lot of experience, a lot of even creation and art and design is happening now in the Rift.
And then the thing that's so interesting about virtual reality, the thing that a lot of people feel has the most potential, is that unlike any other tech platform, it's sort of a whole new way to communicate. That's actually what Facebook likes so much about it, that you can interact with people in a totally different way.
Hey, so frame this in the 3D television context for me, would you? Everybody, you know, 3 years ago was like, oh my God, 3D TV, it's going to be amazing.
Yep.
And now not. So
much like 3D TV, this does involve large, uncomfortable glasses. And I think that's going to be, that's a legitimate barrier for people to overcome, that and price.
Yeah.
I will say I tried out the new version of Oculus Rift today. I played ping pong with a guy who was in another room. It's the kind of thing a lot of people say you have to try to understand. It's very cool.
All right. So you're the target audience here. You're going to spend $1,500?
Yeah. I might wait a couple of years. I've already spent my $99, though, by gosh.
Well, there you go. Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent in Las Vegas at the CES. Thank you, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
While the broader housing market in this country has by and large shaken off the crash and the Great Recession, there is a distinct slice of it that's still changing. Public housing projects have been coming down in American cities for a while now. The idea is to reduce the density of poverty, to give people a chance to get into new neighborhoods using vouchers instead, and then ultimately to give those folks a chance to get on the road to a better economic future. But finding a place to live where you want to live rather than where you are told you can live can be tricky. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship went to Tyndall Heights in Macon, Georgia, to see how that works.
Tyndall Heights is 28 acres of 75-year-old red brick or avocado green block, more than 400 apartments total. The Macon Housing Authority has a plan to replace this with something less dense and more modern. But first, everyone has to move out. For Osset Reeves, this is welcome news.
Me, I was already ready to move, so I'm excited about it, and I'm glad that they're doing this.
Reeves is a college student. She and her children have lived here for 5 years.
I would like to get a house.
And she has another dream.
Well, it's going to be better because my son would be able to go to a better school.
That might not be an option. That's because her choices will be limited by the Section 8 Tenant Protection Voucher, or TPV, that will pay part of the rent at her new place. There might be nothing available in the area's one grade-A school district that meets Section 8 requirements. And most of the places Reeves could pick as her new home fall in local school districts with failing grades on federal standardized tests. But Reeves won't get a look at her housing choices until she has her voucher in hand.
That's why we make sure that our residents know that, you know, don't move or you won't be eligible for a TPV.
That's June Parker, head of the Macon Housing Authority. She says the relocation vouchers issued by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, offer people real choice. Once Reeves and others receive their vouchers, they'll have 120 days to find a place. But for now, there's no list of properties for her to look at.
I think that's pretty common. There's no one perfect list. There's no one perfect place.
That's Linda Couch, the Senior Vice President for Policy at the National Low Income Housing Coalition. I spent a week on the internet trying to find Section 8 housing. I found 195 local Section 8 properties all outside that grade A school district. I learned about school opportunities by plotting my list against another map of schools and test scores. Your Googling skills may vary, but remember, many people in public housing don't have internet access. Linda Couch says having one huge list would be great, but
it's not feasible in the world of rapidly changing vacancies and lease-ups.
HUD officials say keeping track of day-to-day housing markets is the job of local housing authorities. The Macon Housing Authority does have a list of 900 local landlords, but it doesn't keep a list of their properties. And Osset Reeves won't have access to that information until after she's been given her voucher. Linda Couch says it's one thing to talk about lists.
It's another thing talking about having a quality resource for tenants to start their search and really get a leg up on getting their families into neighborhoods of opportunity.
The value of a voucher can make it hard to move to better school districts. Those values are based on average rents across whole housing markets. So low rents on one end of town can drag the average down and cut off access to more expensive housing. Recognizing that problem, June Parker says housing authorities regularly try to recruit new landlords. But there are limits.
If the homeowner or the landlord chooses not to be part of the Section 8 program, we cannot force them.
As a remedy, HUD is experimenting with letting voucher values rise and fall as tenants travel between the zip codes that make up larger housing markets.
Okay, you can come in. Okay.
Oh, yeah, it is a little chilly.
I check in on Osset Reeves at home with her kids about a month after we first meet. She's still waiting on her housing voucher, but she's still excited, and she wants to be deliberate.
I want to get it right the first time.
The clock isn't ticking yet. She still has time. So for now, she can keep dreaming of that perfect house. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Grant Blankenship for Marketplace.
Coming up,
both companies tried to grow a little bit too quickly, or maybe a lot too quickly.
FanDuel and DraftKings and the inner workings of daily fantasy sports. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 252 points today, 1.4%, closed at 16,906. The NASDAQ declined 55 points, about 1.3%, 48.35. The S&P 500 dropped 26 points, 1%, ended things at 1990, a very good year. With crude prices sliding, energy stocks took an especially hard hit. Southwestern Energy skidded 12.5%. Marathon Oil declined 11% today. After AutoNation's CEO warned of a glut in the luxury auto market, the car dealer share slid 10.5%. GM down 3.5%, Ford off 4%. Hedge fund Starboard Value called for changes to Yahoo's board and management, as well as a shift in strategy. At that, it has to be said, troubled company. Company stock, however, didn't move much on that news, down just 0.1%. Bonds up, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.17%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sometimes changes in the way that we live our lives are transient. They're temporary, driven, and they're driven, you know, by cheap marketing ploys. Sometimes, though, it's real, genuine social change that's happening out there. Take, for just one instance, the absolutely booming business in men's grooming. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
We're in the bathroom of an East Village apartment.
Let me turn the light on here.
Colin Spector shares this apartment with his girlfriend.
My name's Colin Spector. We are in New York City. I'm 27 years old.
And he's given us a tour of all the things he uses on his body and his face.
So we've got some Axe re-energizing 2-in-1 body hair shower gel, Nivea Men Maximum Hydration Nourishing Lotion for dry skin.
His hair and his eyebrows, too.
Yeah. I'll shape them a little bit with some tweezers, some scissors sometimes.
The fact that Colin has so much product is representative of a steady change in how men think about and buy personal care products, what really we should call beauty products.
The men's personal care market is estimated to reach sales of $4.2 billion in 2015.
Margie Nanengay is a home and personal care analyst with Mintel.
15% growth over the past 5 years.
Men's personal grooming products have proliferated. Just over half of men surveyed by Mintel used specialty skincare products. Almost 60% used facial skincare products, and 80% used hand or body lotion.
The male skincare marketplace over the last several years has outpaced, sometimes doubled, the growth of women's skincare.
Joseph Grigsby is vice president of global marketing for Estee Lauder's Lab Series Skincare for Men. Estee Lauder as a company has been making skincare products for men since the 60s, but it created an entire men's skincare group in 2014.
We have gotten over the hump and the stigma of using product to where there's an expectation for men to do that.
Now, if you ask sociologists like Lisa Wade, assistant professor at Occidental College, they'll say that the most surprising thing about this is not that it's happening.
What's surprising to me is that it's taken this long.
Capitalism is relentless, and it has been trying for a long time to get men and women to buy beauty products, even in the 20s and 30s. The thing is, women weren't buying into it much then either.
It was seen as something that only Jezebels participated in.
Kristen Barber is assistant professor of sociology at Southern Illinois University and author of the forthcoming book, Styling Masculinity. She says personal grooming products like cosmetics and creams, these things didn't become super gendered in the first place until World War II.
Women moved in greater numbers into factory work, producing ammunition and war machines.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter.
Barber says there was a lot of cultural insecurity around this time about the dissolution of gender roles.
So cosmetics were sold as part of an attempt to reinforce biological differences between men and women, right? So if you're going to go work in the factory, make sure you continue to look like a woman. Wear some lipstick, be ready for your man when he comes home from war.
That gendering of personal grooming products persisted.
Because that's so recent, companies had a really difficult time then turning around and saying, okay, and men can use it.
Part of the reason that's changing, according to marketers and sociologists alike, is who is leading the way. Young men, ages 18 to 34.
Because they don't necessarily have the historical memory of the work that these companies had to do to attach it to womanhood.
The younger generation is very comfortable in using products to make them look good.
That's Joseph Grigsby with Estee Lauder again.
Millennials are exposing their life and exposing how they look every day.
Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Vine.
We are living in a selfie culture.
Let me take a selfie.
Grigsby says men's changing approach to beauty products is also about what makes men feel like men. Sociologist Lisa Wade agrees.
I think that we're in a period where we're really unsure where masculinity goes next. There's very little basis on which men and women are different anymore.
Which means, say several sociologists, men are looking for ways to be different. So if you look at the way grooming products are marketed, you find they've become hyper-masculinized. Exfoliators became manly scrubs. Perfumes became pheromone body sprays like Axe. Deodorants like Old Spice became markers of adult manhood. There's even a jawline-enhancing cream from Lab Series. So in a way, we are in a cultural moment, one where masculinity is being defined with the very products it was once defined against. And that is making billions. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
While the playoff-bound NFL teams work out their game plans for Sunday's first round, a word now about fantasy sports, where fans put together imaginary player lineups and create virtual teams of their own. If you've caught even a glimpse of a professional sporting event the past 6 months or so, you've probably seen ads for the daily fantasy sports sites FanDuel and DraftKings. To say they've become popular is an understatement, as is saying they have become controversial, because they have become, in fact, quite controversial. Jay Kang writes about daily fantasy sports, DFS it's called, and the inner workings thereof in this coming weekend's New York Times Magazine. Jay, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. It all seems, I guess, harmless enough, which is what you say in this piece, but you also go on to write that it's predatory, it is rapacious, you say, and it's all based on the big guys going after the little guys. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think that the second that you step out of games with your friends, and it's not just you and your buddy in California, or you and your buddy in, you know, in Massachusetts playing one another, and DraftKings or FanDuel is handling the transfer of money, that's when you start encountering almost immediately high-volume players who are using tools that you have no idea even exist. And, you know, you would never know existed unless you really did some research on your own.
When you say tools, what do you mean? What are they doing?
So the most common thing is called scripting, and that scripting is the use of a third-party software that plugs directly into either DraftKings or FanDuel's site and allows these guys to enter thousands of lineups at once.
And you say this all happens pretty much with the site's, if not open acquiescence, then certainly a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of thing, and they let it go on.
Well, yeah, back in July, there was one incident, which is, you know, too sort of complicated and boring to go into, but it resulted in a lot of people in the community getting angry, in the DFS community, including some other high-volume players. And the response from the companies was actually, instead of sort of cracking down and saying, you know, these are our rules, their response was to legalize it.
Let me back you out of the weeds for a minute and talk about this whole phenomenon of DraftKings and FanDuel and all that. The rise and fall, the speed of it, it's happened in less than an NFL season, basically, right? I mean, they spent gazillions of dollars in ads at the beginning of the season, and now attorneys general all over the country are looking at these guys sort of in the crosshairs.
Yeah, there's a sense out there, I think, when you talk to some of the people in the industry and some of the people who have been covering this, that actually it was the ads that got people wise to it. Because you're right, at the beginning of the NFL season, they were running so often that everybody was making jokes about it. And I just think that anytime something tries to grow that quickly, and especially if it's kind of has some ties to gambling at the, you know, and it seems like gambling at the beginning, then it's going to invite a lot of scrutiny. And so I think that both companies tried to grow a little bit too quickly, or maybe a lot too quickly, and that they thought they were protected by like one federal carve out in a anti-gambling law. And right. What it turns out is that like the state governments didn't agree with them. So like the state governments are the ones that have been cracking
going
down.
After them. Yeah. Let me get you then to the title of this piece. It's called How the Daily Fantasy Sports Industry Turns Fans into Suckers. How long can this industry last if devotees like you are saying, you know what, man, this is a sham?
I don't know, because, you know, I think that some of the legal problems that have been presented and the, sort of the coverage of the legal problems, it doesn't take into account that, you know, this is still operating in 44 states. Like, once we got out of the phone, I could enter in a lineup onto DraftKings right now, you know. I don't think that we will see sort of the revolutionizing of fantasy sports or sports watching. I think all of that has already been started to scale back, and I think it'll probably be done by the start of the next NFL season.
J. Jay Kang, he writes in the New York Times Magazine this coming weekend on Daily Fantasy Sports. Jay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, getting us back to North Korea and its nuclear test last night. We talked about sanctions up at the top of the program. The North Koreans are thinking about them, too. Here is just a brief snippet of the official English language announcement of the test from Pyongyang last night. Quote, "The U.S. is a gang of cruel robbers, which has worked hard to bring even a nuclear disaster to the DPRK, not content with having imposed the thrice-cursed and unheard-of political isolation, economic blockade, and military pressure on it." So, that. All right, that's all we got. The Dow closed down 252 points today, about 1.4%. The NASDAQ down 55 points, about 1.3%. There, the S&P 500 dropped 26 points, 1% pretty much on the nose. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lant, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow, everybody. Yep, it's 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.